Session number 17180.
Mr. Bingley, Reel 2, you're just coming into Dunkirk.
When I met a major in the Royal Army Medical Corps, and he said, right ho, lads, go and lie on those stretchers. Now, there were two rows of stretchers, enormous great rows, part filled with soldiers. So I said to him, before I can go and lie down, sir, one of my soldiers, Eric Croston, is very badly wounded. I'd be most grateful if you would operate on him immediately. You see, I said, and I don't wish to go and lie on the stretcher until I know that you have started to operate on him. He said, for goodness sake, man, go and lie down. I said, no. Let me see you put him on the operating table, and when I know you're ready to operate, then my soldiers and I will cheerfully go and lie on a stretcher. So he said, all right then, and we duly carried Eric Croston into the studio, the surgery. He said, there you are, and I'm going to start on him now. Are you satisfied? I said, yes, sir. So we duly went, lay down. And eventually, a hospital boat comes along, and we go on board, hand our rifles to the military police, who put them in an armory inside the hospital ship. And we eventually arrive at Harwich in England. When we arrive at Harwich, there was a long white train with red crosses on it, a hospital train, and it made slow journeys all the way to London. And every few miles, it would stop, and maybe 4 or 8 wounded chaps would be taken by ambulance to a local hospital. It took many hours to arrive at London, and when we did so, there, to our delight, were a group of nuns who came on board and gave us all a glass of milk on board the train, gave us a glass of milk and a slab of Cadbury's fruit nut chocolate. It was delicious. And whereupon the Salvation Army came on board the train and gave us survivor's kit. It was a pillow slip with pajamas, shaving kit, washing kit, writing pad, pen, and a tin of 50 cigarettes, a most acceptable gift. It was about 11 o'clock at night when our train arrived at Exminster in Devon, and arrived first of all at Exeter in Devon. And when we arrived at Exeter, to our amazement, there was a crowd of some 2,000 people waiting to welcome us. There was a band and 2 ambulances. We got a wonderful reception, and the 4 Royal West Kents and my 4 Middlesex lads, we were loaded onto 2 ambulances and we went to the hospital at Exminster. Some 24 hours later, 2 dozen more wounded chaps come, and they go into a main ward. Now, the hospital at Exminster is actually a mental hospital, but the British orthopaedic folks took over 2 wards and a large ward for us wounded soldiers. And we were treated splendidly, absolutely splendidly. I had only been in the hospital a few days when the matron came and saw me, and she said, do you remember delivering one of your soldiers to a major in the medical corps at Dunkirk and asking him to immediately operate on one of your soldiers? I said, oh yes, Eric Croston. I have a message for you from the major to say that he did operate on the lad, but he died, and that he'd personally gone to the funeral and put flowers on the grave for me. It happened then that 7 weeks to elapse before I could go and see Eric Croston's parents and tell them what had happened to Eric, and that he was buried in France. But it was very kind, I thought, of that major to send me the message. Very kind indeed. Now, after I'd been in the hospital 7 weeks, one of the company sergeant majors of the Middlesex said to me, "I'm leaving hospital now because I volunteered for a brand new parachute regiment that Winston Churchill has formed, a parachute unit," he said, "and I'm going to join them." "Oh," I said, "in that case, when you get back, will you please nominate me for that parachute unit?" I said, "I would love to join them." I said, "and I'll get my discharge straight away." So off goes the sergeant major, and I managed to wangle my freedom from the hospital at Exminster, and I went back to the battalion. When I got back there, I explained to the colonel that I wished to join this new para unit. Well, he said, "by the way," he said, "I'm about to invite you to apply for a commission in the Middlesex Regiment, you see." He said, "that would be far better for you to do that than join a parachute unit." I said, "well, it won't, sir." I said, "because I happen to know that when you're commissioned, you pay for your uniform, £240, 4 months before you get your grant." I said, "I can't do that." I said, "and neither can I go a month and wait for the pay, because an officer's pay is monthly in arrears. That just won't do." I said, "I'll have to wait until I can pay for my uniform." So the colonel said, "ask your father for the money." Oh, I said, "I wouldn't dream of embarrassing him like that." I said, "if I get a commission, and I'd be greatly honoured if I do, it will be because I've been able to pay for my uniform from the word go." I said, "now, if I wait till I'm 21, a bit older than I am," I said, "I'll save the money," I said, "and I'll do it that way, but I won't borrow from my father." "Oh," he said, "all right, good thinking. I'll recommend you for the parachute unit." Now, it happened that that parachute unit was known as Number 2 Para Commando. And the role set for us was, if the Germans came, to drop on them, blow up all their heavy equipment with Amatol. We had an officer in the unit called Jock Gammon, and he invented what was known as the Gammon bomb. In the early days, parents did the laundry in what was called a dolly blue bag, and Jock Gammon got a supply of several hundred dolly blue bags, which would take 8 ounces of Amatol. And if you put a fulminate of mercury detonator into the Amatol and crimped it, you could set it for 2 or 5 minutes. And by placing it on the object you wanted to blow up, you could always reckon on getting on reducing that vehicle to scrap iron. The explosive was so deadly. So we were equipped with that, but it happened that the Germans did not come. So our role was altered, and instead of being Number 2 Para Commando, we now became the 11th Special Air SAS, Special Air Service Unit. And the same personnel went from one unit to the other. Our role was now changed. And the role was to be to keep the Germans occupied in Europe. The Royal Air Force and the Royal Navy had performed a wonderful task in destroying all the landing craft that they had collected from the rivers in France, Belgium and Holland, and accumulated them on the beaches in France. And the intention was in having a group of 50 here and a few miles away another group of 50. But when the Royal Air Force discovered them, they shattered them, or the Royal Navy did, with gunfire or bombs, and the Germans never really got going. We do know that they sent the SS on a raid in barges towards Dover, But I understand that the Royal Navy flooded the sea with petrol, and the Royal Air Force set it on fire with tracer, and that several hundred Germans were burnt to death in their boats. And that was the last attempt the Germans made to land in Britain. So a new role was found for the unit, and that was to help the Royal Air Force. The Germans had rumbled that the Royal Air Force were using radar to get their aircraft in the air to intercept the German bombers and fighters, and they were utilizing radar for themselves. And it was necessary to find out how advanced the German radar was compared with ours, and that was a useful task for the SAS to do. Go and drop by parachute, gather the radar, bring it back, and let Royal Air Force technicians examine it. In the meantime, of course, we were also, the SAS, testing the defences in Britain. We tested all the bomber stations, all the fighter stations, and many other defences, Royal Navy, to test them, coming in unexpected. And there were quite a few casualties inflicted on both sides because apparently the Royal Air Force were never warned until we arrived what was happening. It was only when our people actually came down that the station commanders were told, this is a mock raid, not a real raid, and it prevented the RAF dropping, destroying our fellows on the ground. But at the same time, we were able to get on the ground and warn them that it was possible. So it was near as the real thing as you could get.
Were you on these raids testing security?
Yeah. Oh, golly, yes.
Which ones did you test?
We went right throughout the country. We were testing the Air Force. So we were doing it as a regular thing. And also, we were attacking gasworks as well.
And this was in the summer of...
Latter half of 40 and 41.
And would you drop by parachute?
Yes. Oh, drop by parachute, yes. We dropped by parachute on the stations, you see, yeah. But it happened that the stations only got a last-minute warning. I imagine what happened, well, how they got the warning, I don't know. But we tested all the defences, fighter and bomber, and naval stations, and it was as near to the real thing as could be to check on the alertness. And one has to admit that we caught many of them napping.
What did you think of the state of alertness in general?
Well, I suppose I must admire it. They didn't injure our fellows. I mean, there were lots of hand-to-hand fighting, you know, but there were no bullets fired. No one fired bullets at any time, which is a blessing. Well, actually, when we dropped, our ammunition was at the bottom of our haversacks, you know. We only had blanks in our pouches. And the live ammo was in the haversacks. Yeah.
And this was the 11th Special...
Eleventh Special Air Service, SAS. But in the October 1942, Hitler said that the SAS were thugs and murderers and would be hung when caught. So the government decided that no British soldier was going to be hung. So we were disbanded and made into the 1st Parachute Battalion. All our illicit weapons were taken away from us, and we were equipped correctly. And General Montgomery said, thank heavens we no longer have these these soldiers with these wicked weapons. Thank goodness we now got some civilized infantry parachutists. Those are all Winston Montgomery's comments.
What happened to you from then on, from 1942?
Oh, well, from 1942, as soon as that happened, I was sent to Mons Officer Cadet School as an officer cadet for training. And the brigade, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd parachute battalions, left England in the November 42 to take part in Operation Torch, which was a landing in North Africa, in Algiers and that area. And they were to advance on Tunis and meet up with Montgomery's 8th Army.
What are your personal memories of the North Africa landings?
Well, my landing, I knew very little about it because my officer cadet training took 17 weeks. And also I did a 4-week course on motorcycle training at pre-op two. I did 4 weeks pre-op through on motorcycle training, and then I did the 17 weeks officer cadet training at the 161 Royal Military Academy at Aldershot. And as soon as I was commissioned, within the week, we were on a boat to go to Algiers. And I then joined up with the battalion, and it was then that the Germans surrendered at Cape Bon. And we then started training when I joined the battalion.
So you weren't in the fighting in Tunisia?
I wasn't in the fighting in Tunisia. So we then trained for the invasion of Sicily. And we went to a place called Mistagenum on the coast, where there was a piece of ground similar to what we would meet in Catania in Sicily, and we practiced capturing the bridge there, where there were mock pillboxes, 4 of them, 2 on the north and 2 on the south of the river, and there we were. And it was from, and while there, we were based at a place called, we were based at Sousse. And there were airfields surrounded all the way round Sousse with half a dozen bombers here and half a dozen troop carrying planes there. And it was from Sousse that we flew to Syracuse in Sicily, and from there were to drop on the bridge, the Primosola Bridge, at the junction of the Cornalunga River. Now, the whole thing was absolute nonsense. We had previously been flown by French Canadians who were highly skilled pilots. But as soon as the Germans capitulated at Cape Bon, we lost our Canadian pilots and we received brand new American pilots who only 3 months earlier had been tug plane pilots. They'd been flown Dakotas, but if they didn't know where they were, they merely came down to a crossroads in America and said, "Where are we, buddy?" And they'd be told, and they'd go up in the air and carry on. Now, they would like to have carried on that same method of map reading in Sicily. The whole thing was chaotic because the Americans were dropping on the south of Sicily, while the British were dropping on the north coast. And the aircraft were getting mixed up. And it also happened that instead of having a navigator on each American aircraft, there was only one per 9 planes, one navigator to 9 Dakota C-47s. And it meant that if any of the 8 got missed the leading plane, then they were up the gumtree. And so it proved. We were allowed a 9-mile corridor to fly from Sousse to Malta, and on arrival at Malta, we would be directed by Eureka to Syracuse in Sicily, and then from another Eureka to the bridge at Primosola. But the Americans flew outside the 9-mile corridor, and they flew over the Royal Navy. The Royal Navy had only shortly before been bombed by the Luftwaffe. And when more planes came along, the Air Force saw more Luftwaffe, and they opened fire. My aircraft got scattered. The parachutes in the aircraft got scattered, and we were spread all over the plane. It took me, I had to unhook my chute, and it took me 20 minutes to get my remaining 70 men back into their seat without tripping up on each other's parachute. And it took 20 minutes to do that, get them organized nicely. We then arrived at Malta and flew to Syracuse when the Italian anti-aircraft gunners opened fire on us, and the pilot took evasive action again and threw us again in a heap inside the aircraft. I had the task again of taking 20 minutes to sort them out, which I did, but it was quite a problem. Well, eventually we carried on, and the engineer came up to me and said, we'll be at the objective in 10 minutes, sir. I'll open the door for you, and will you start hooking up? I said, thank you very much. He opened the door, I looked out, and I said to him, you have overflown the objective. I said, tell the pilot, you've overflown the objective, you are bound by Mount Etna, which is nonsense. I said, ask him to turn round, find the river Sumito, and drop us on the bridge. The engineer delivered my message, and the pilot sent the message. He said, tell that limey, he damn well jumps when I tell him to. So I sent the message back, tell the pilot, balls, I'm not jumping where he says. I'm responsible for the lives of my 18 men. We're not going to do an atom of good on a volcano. Tell him to use his common sense, tell him to fly on a reverse course, and when he comes to the river, I said, if he goes down to the ground level, I'll unhook, and with my binoculars, when I see the river, I'll tell you, you tell him, he can then go up to 800 feet, I'll have re-hooked up by then, and we'll go out as close to the bridge. You can drop us on the bridge if you like, but that is where I'm going. That is where my men are going to do their best work, not on a volcano. And the message came back. The pilot says, okay, buddy, you're the boss. And that was a major, an American major said that. So I was pleased with that, you know. So I just had time to get hooked up. And we went out, and it was pitch black. I got knocked out on my landing. And when I came round, I thought to myself, where the blazes am I? And I looked up at the sky, and I could recognize some of the stars. And I thought, yes, I know where I am. And I set a course for the bridge, and I was slap bang on. And when I arrived at the bridge, there was only one person there, the colonel of the 3rd Parachute Battalion. He had been cut off from his stick. He'd lost his stick, and he made his way there. And when I got there, he said, thank heavens you've arrived. He said, I'm the only person here. He said, and I was frightened you were the Germans coming. I said, no, all is well, sir. Well, he said, now you're here. He said, we've got to capture the 2 pillboxes on the south side of this river. Oh, I said, that'll be no problem. I said, but before we do that, sir, if you don't mind, there's going to be a patrol, Italian patrol, circumnavigating the 4 pillboxes. I said, I must nab them first. And when I've got those 4 men, whatever they are, it's bound to be a patrol of 4, When I've got them in the bag, I'll then go and I'll capture one pillbox at a time. He said, good thinking. Tomorrow leaf, another stick comes along from my battalion, 12 men only, commanded by a corporal. The rest of the stick and the officers that should have been with it had been scattered elsewhere. They'd been dropped wide. And when they came, I said to the corporal, thank goodness you're here. I said, I'm about to go and ambush a patrol of four. Then I'm going to capture the first pillbox, then the second. Will you line your men up in firing position facing the second pillbox? I said, and when I've caught the patrol, I will then capture the first pillbox. And I put him in position, and sure enough, I hadn't been in position more than a few moments when I heard the patrol come along. And we opened fire. I had taken two men with me to look for the patrol, because I'd left the rest of my men to cover the number one pillbox. And I took two fellas with me, and we were in a perfect position to ambush these four men. And we fired at them and killed two, wounded one, and the fourth one surrendered. So I duly handed the prisoner and the wounded man over to the RSM of the 3rd Battalion, who then arrived, and the dead men were removed as well. And I then set about taking the first pillbox. I have always been considered accurate with throwing grenades, so I decided that I alone would throw the grenades at the pillbox. I threw my first grenade, hit the side of the pillbox, my second did, but my third one went straight through the aperture, exploded inside, and set fire to some inflammable material. There was an unholy bang, and everything blew up inside that pillbox, killing all 17 men inside. It was a terrible business, and flames were coming outside the pillbox. So I thought, right, I can ignore that. So I then set about the second pillbox. I only had to throw two grenades at the second pillbox, and those fellas learnt their lesson, and they waved the white flag. And they came out. But it happened that a major who commanded the Italians was with the pillboxes at the north of the river. He came down opening fire and he shot me through the hand. And his men were surrendering to me under the white flag. That Italian major got shot very rapidly by my fellows. When my fellows saw that he'd shot me, they thought, we're put pay to this chap, and that's what they did. So they shot him. We handed the 17 Italians over to the RSM of the 3rd Para, and with that I then went across the bridge